Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. I want to remind everyone we are Zooming on Wednesday morning, so a lot could happen Wednesday afternoon and Wednesday night, but we will not be discussing it probably till Friday, so please excuse me. You know what the gig is. We're going to start our show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I'm watching the whole services around John Lewis, and I'm thinking, wow, patriotism, consistency, never giving up. I listen to the voice of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, patriotism, a powerful voice, never giving up, and he knew he was risking his career. He knew it when he told and testified. When he told his father, "Don't worry, Dad, it'll be all right," everyone in that room knew that wasn't true. And it's become more and more self-evident. All right, everyone, between now and the election, you hear the voice of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
My favorite place to mine for information and conversation and really smart people is The Conversation. And I go to theconversation.com like all the time. It's almost embarrassing that I sort of go there on a regular basis. But ever since I found it, I suddenly realized, actually, this is something I have been begging faculty to do. Because I would go into classrooms, what is it, publish or perish, and they would talk to their students. But they had so much knowledge that never was given access to the public at large. And I wanted them to write op-eds, and I wanted them to write for magazines. And they would kind of look at me and roll their eyes. Well, the good news is I could have invented theconversation.com, but they invented it for me because it is now in I don't know how many countries around the world, and they pull in PhDs and professors from every country to write about their area of expertise and to connect the dots. Well, as usual, Arnie goes, and what does she find? She finds Taryn Morrissey, who's an associate professor at the Department of Public Administration and Public School of Public Affairs at the American University. She's a policy researcher whose work aims to examine and improve public policies for children and families. So she's near and dear to my heart. And that's her bio. Now you need to understand why I really grabbed her. Kids' school schedules have never matched parents' work obligations, and the pandemic is making things worse. Let me welcome Professor Morrissey to the program and just let you know, Taryn, that as I was reading this, let me tell you the theme of everything I said when I ran for governor. And I was running on education reform, and I said the problem with schools is that our school calendar has more in common with raising corn than raising kids. You have heard that line a million times. With that as sort of my sort of foundational statement, let's be honest, schools originally did accommodate people's work. Schools originally did understand the nature of families and the nature of works, and they threaded school so that school could operate and families could still also function, bringing in the corn, planting the fields, and then sending the kids when basically not much was happening. So it's ironic that here they understood the necessity of education, but also the flexibility of recognizing the needs of a family, and it works. The problem is it got cemented in place as if somehow I'm in working the back 40 and I'm still, you know, planting the cotton and I'm doing none of those things. Welcome to the program. Explain why you wrote this now, because I think the pandemic, it's a horrific event. At the same time, it's a wake-up call and forcing us to recognize all the mistakes, all the inflexibility, all the things that we have sort of put on hold or been in denial about, and now we can no longer do that.
Well, thank you so much for having me today on this important issue that I've thought about quite a bit professionally as well as personally. I have two young children under the age of 7 who are now always home. And I'm fortunate to be employed full-time. My husband is fortunate to be employed full-time. That said, it's really hard to balance full-time employment with two young children at home. It's not meant to be this way. And we're in a really privileged position. There are many families who have to leave the house to work, for example, or who are facing material hardship or who are single parents. This current time is just really difficult, but it was hard before. As you point out, our school system used to recognize the economic realities of families. And when both parents and multi-generational caregivers used to work on farms, there were times where school was revolved around that sort of schedule. And then as families shifted, as more families, there was a more of a breadwinner model, and there was always somebody at home, schools kind of solidified in that schedule. And it doesn't really make sense. In most families, there isn't somebody at home most of the time.
Exactly. And you know, it's so interesting, Taryn, when all of a sudden everybody started talking about latchkey kids, I'm thinking, well, that was 30 years ago. And if they're talking about latchkey kids, why didn't they figure out then that maybe there was something wrong with the school schedule? Because latchkey kids has been not only an obvious situation, but to some extent it's even gotten worse because parents are not just working two jobs, sometimes they're working two and three jobs. So you're not just a latchkey for 2 hours, you might be a latchkey for 5 hours.
Right, or non-standard hours, they're working nights and weekends. Yes. Our system just doesn't support the realities of families' work. We've had this false dichotomy between education and childcare for years. And much of that, I think, results from the ambivalence about mothers working. But all of a sudden, at age 5, children become a public good and they go into public education, K through 12. That's supported with our tax dollars. That's largely operated independent of parents' work. Before then, to accommodate work schedules, parents have to pay, for the most part, out of their own pockets. There's relatively little public investment in the early years. And so that's a whole other problem. From a child's point of view, a high quality early care and education experience, or a high quality middle childhood educational experience, you know, we're not talking about, there's not this difference between childcare or daycare so parents can work and education so that children can learn. It's one and the same.
Well, isn't it interesting, Taryn? This pandemic really is exposing a lot. And what is it exposing is how much schools are daycare, how much schools are food care, how much schools are health care, how much schools are emotional social care. I mean, it's like, teachers will have told you for a long time, we're doing a lot. And they really are doing a lot. And all of a sudden, when parents are suddenly in the situation where they are now responsible for sort of juggling whatever the homework is or whatever, and taking care of their kids and having their kids home all the time, I think they're becoming to become more aware of how important education is, not just in, reading, writing, and arithmetic, but what it provides for you to be a capable family of surviving, what it means to really educate a child, because it is an incredible challenge. And it's very hard to do your gig work, your other work, as well as raising your kid and educating your kid. And at the same time, Taryn, you mentioned that it wasn't good before. It wasn't only not good before, but if all these women are in the workforce, and most of us now live in nuclear families, so you can't go home to grandma, you can't go home to an extended family, how could employers and parents and schools ignore it for so long?
I think it's because we have this ethos of individual responsibility. And so parents, and often, at least the early years, it's brief, right? And so you're so wrapped up in having a young child, you're so wrapped up in trying to pay and find childcare that's really difficult to find and afford. And then it's over and children are in K through 12, and then you're on to the next crisis. And so you're worried about summer and you're worried about aftercare, and if you have to work a weekend shift, how do you figure that out? And so I think people have taken it upon themselves to just figure it out. And that's been the prevailing advice, I think, or what employers and policymakers have assumed families are going to do. And it doesn't have to be that hard. Most people become parents. All of us have been children. You know, this is not a women's issue. This is not a unique segment of the population. We are all, our Social Security and Medicare are all going to be supported by the next generation. And so we all have a stake in this.
So as we're looking going forward, because we're realizing that this year is going to be a challenge on steroids. It's going to be a challenge because schools are trying to figure out whether they can open. We're hearing places like New York and maybe even my own school system is talking about every other day, like life happens every other day. So what do I do in the other days? And what if I'm working? And who's going to take care of the kid on the other day? And it sounds good in isolation. It makes no sense in life. You know, life needs to roar its ugly head again and say, excuse me, how does this work? You were mentioning one of the things about kindergarten, for example, that a lot of places still have half-day kindergarten. So we just got full-day kindergarten in New Hampshire. By the way, we were, I think, the last state in the nation to mandate kindergarten, period. So we didn't really give a crap about five-year-olds, all right? So this is so interesting. We finally figured out that five-year-olds matter, and we then mandated kindergarten, but not full-day. Do you know where the big push for full-day kindergarten came from? It came from employers. And you know why? Because they suddenly realized that their employees, of which there still was a significant number, had to figure out in the middle of the day what to do with their kid. That was not good for worker stability. That was not good for whatever. And so employers were a huge push behind full-day kindergarten. But isn't it interesting? They were there because they saw the economic stability of it. They were there because they saw it really as an extension of daycare that, you know, their employee wouldn't have to pay for because it would be publicly supported. That, again, is something to build on, but we seem to sort of stop at kindergarten and never realize what is really being sort of demanded by both parents as well as employers.
That's right. That's really interesting. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think the economic argument for childcare has gotten more attention in the last couple of months out of necessity. I mean, you have, first of all, the childcare market or an education market, certainly if you add K through 12, employ many, many people and is in crisis right now for various reasons. And secondly, they indirectly allow parents to work. And so the indirect economic benefits are huge. And then thirdly, they're educating the future workforce. And so for all of these reasons, employers have a huge stake in this. There's research demonstrating mothers, and particularly low-income single mothers, their labor force participation responds quite dramatically to the availability of low-cost childcare. As one might expect, it's just so hard to afford it right now. And so there's been research that follows the transition from part day to full day kindergarten, as you might expect, increases parents' work hours, particularly mothers, or even just the entry into kindergarten. If you change the age, people have exploited that age cutoff. And so, and the same thing is true in the younger years. It's more so true in the younger years because childcare for a five-year-old is a lot cheaper than childcare for a one-year-old.
I was telling my two producers that so when I gave birth to my second child, I actually ran for the legislature that year, and I gave birth a week before the election. I had applied for infant daycare when she was 5 months old. Do you know when they called me? When she was a year and a half. That was how long I was on the wait list. So guess who was breastfed on the floor of the legislature? Guess who was breastfed? This is 1984, 85. Okay, so long before everybody was sort of talking about what women were doing, I had no choice. Right. I had no choice. I was elected. And it was really funny. Someone said to me, did you get permission? I said, no. My constituents knew they were getting two. It was pretty obvious. I was running around very pregnant. And they also understood the problem with infant care. And they also knew that I couldn't, it was an affordability issue as well. So, you know, it was okay with them. And therefore, it had to be okay with the New Hampshire legislature. That was 1984. Talk to people now about affordability. Talk to people now about finding it. Taryn, since you are the professor in this, and this is your area of sort of study, is there a system in the world that's doing something right, that recognizes the challenges of work and families? Is there something that we can replicate, model after, massage to make possible? Because again, I'm going to say something. If we have a change of administration because of the pandemic, it is an opportunity to really make change. And you can blame COVID, But in reality, it's better for families and it's better for the economy. So I'll blame anything. Just begin to repair it and make it work.
Most other developed countries are doing better than we are in this respect, in terms of, I mean, just purely demands on workers, number one, or the number of work hours people have, how often they use the vacation benefits that they are entitled to, or how many workers have paid sick leave or paid family leave to begin with, right? And we are improving. So many states are expanding that. And many states are expanding preschool. We're unique in terms of our peer nations in not providing publicly financed education beginning at 4 or 3. Most of our peers begin at 3. And then before that, they subsidize childcare very heavily. Germany has this kind of, they have a more of a federal system similar to the US, for example, that subsidizes care much younger and has public education. Although most other European countries, Australia, have so. Mexico is investing quite a bit in their pre-K programs. Mm-hmm. El Salvador is considering this. And you know, COVID is certainly changing some plans and really straining budgets. But we are unique. And not a good way, I would argue. And we have the pieces here. I mean, it's so similar to healthcare. We have a range of approaches. We have Head Start that we know benefits children who attend it. And this is more of a public system where the dollars go directly from the federal government to local providers and serves low-income kids. We have childcare subsidies that are more like vouchers where families choose the kinds of programs. But all of them serve small fractions of those eligible. Right. Right. And middle-income families who are struggling largely aren't eligible.
That's where you build resentment, Taryn. That's what people don't get. The fact that you're helping people at the very bottom and half of them don't even know that they could get the help or they don't access the help, which is part of the frustration. And then you have middle-class families who are just sitting there going, I'm working full-time, I can't do this. So what do I give up in order to make sure that my kid has, you know, the after-school care or the daycare or the whatever? And instead of making it sort of an across-the-board sort of foundational response, then not only will you not have that resentment, but then people will see that they can lock arms and invest in it together, which makes so sense. And I'm going to, again, share an experience with myself. My brother went to private school. I went to public school. Do you know what the difference was? My brother's private school, he would be picked up at 7 o'clock. He would be returned home at 5:30. Every day after school, there was 2 hours of something, whether it was sports, whether it was theater, whether it was extra help. But you didn't end at 2:30 or 3 o'clock. You ended at 5 o'clock. I ended in public school at 2:15, okay? And I'm thinking, what is it about that private school calendar or that private school clock that made them understand that it wasn't just the academics, that extra 2 hours was both good for the kid because it maybe, you know, gave them an opportunity to express themselves in different ways, but it turned out it was good for the family. Because mm-hmm. the family would be home by the time the kid got home. And I remember thinking at age 16 that I was ticked off, you know, and now I'm 66. And yet that model, as you point out, there are models out there, but usually it's the wealthy that can access the model or the very poor that may be given some assistance for that model. But that doesn't solve the problem. It just sort of creates a more of a sort of a buckshot approach to what we know isn't working.
Right. That's right.
Who can hear this, Taryn? Who's ready to respond to this? Because we really do know that there are going to be significant demands on the healthcare system to respond environmentally to climate change. Teachers are afraid of going to school this year. They're writing their obituaries. They're saying, I didn't sign up for this. Parents are trying to figure out what the right thing to do is. They don't know, but they know that it's almost impossible to figure out how to actually go to work 5 days a week when your kids are going to be home 2 or 3 days a week. I mean, it's just, how do you solve that problem? We're just exacerbating the fragile economy. So I'm just trying to figure out, is there a champion that can articulate what we need to do and can lock arms, let's be honest with you, with the business community, because in the end, they will be one of the biggest beneficiaries.
That's right. I think also the severe disproportionate impacts of this pandemic have been great on marginalized communities, on racial and ethnic minorities, on low-income families, and that it's exposed all those disparities and widened them even dramatically. And so we need solutions in the short term and long term that address those gaps, as well as help everybody raise all boats as well. And I do think, you know, in the short term, we need money. I think K through 12 education needs money to stay afloat, as to build in safety provisions, but also childcare providers need money to keep their doors open. We're going to lose an estimated 40% of licensed childcare slots because of this permanently. And so what does that mean for the economy as it reopens, quote unquote? You know, mothers, this is going to set back mothers decades in terms of progress on careers and family economic security. Parents rely on two incomes. So this is going to have really wide ranging effects. And then in the long term, we need to, as you said, not go back to the status quo. We can think more creatively, and there are plans out there. It's been really exciting for me, who's done this work for years now, to see plans that childcare talked about in the presidential election, and Vice President Biden put out a plan last week that's really comprehensive and would help families' bottom line in the meantime.
And I would love to go talk to some of my like conservative friends who are always talking about, well, it was good for my grandfather, or it was good for me, or whatever. You know, they're always sort of going the throwback. And yet we started the conversation, which talked about the fact that the school calendar had more in common with raising corn than raising kids. But that's when we were all growing the corn. And in a lot of ways, I think we need to reflect on if schools understood how to thread the needle, you know, in the 1800s, in the 1700s, then what is so smart about us that we don't have the capacity to affect the kind of change that both accommodates a changing economy, that accommodates a changing demographic, that accommodates, you know, income inequality? There are so many challenges, but we think we're so sophisticated. You know, we're on the cutting edge, except when it comes to education, we fall off the edge, which is just in a way so depressing and so shocking as we look at this. And yet I think it really is an opportunity to rethink. But as the one of the group that I think we need to talk to is we really need to talk to teachers. Mm-hmm. And too often than not, we talk about how we need to change the educational system. And for like a brief moment, I was going to do some work for the NEA after I lost my race for governor. It didn't last because I confronted them. Oh, well. Anyway, but I actually do think we need to bring teachers into this, because if we're talking about extending the day, or if we're talking about extending the calendar, then I think we need to figure out what does it mean to be a teacher? Because, you know, right now they're also in their sort of comfortable mode, or what they know. And if suddenly the school day lasts a little bit longer, or if suddenly the academic year lasts longer, do we ask the same people to accommodate those extra hours and those extra days, given what, Taryn, you have seen now as a stay-at-home working mother with your kids not going to school? It is not easy, and you only have two.
Right.
All right. So here's the good news. This is a real opportunity to get, I think, a lot of people to be much more sensitive to what happens when you have 15 kids in a classroom, 21 kids in a classroom, 23 kids in a classroom, whatever it is, for people to understand the challenges of being an effective teacher. And if you want to start adding more to their plate, you're actually going to get less in the way of education.
Teachers are key in this conversation. And I think, you know, extending the school day or extending children's school day doesn't necessarily mean extending the traditional school day, right? It could mean opportunities like sports and art and extracurriculars. I mean, kids developmentally aren't meant to sit in a desk 8 hours a day, right? And so I don't think, you know, anybody would want that. But they could benefit from doing something potentially than going home alone and watching TV. You know, there's a lot of room in the middle, and high-income parents are investing in that. We know that they think that's the case, and they have the resources to provide those opportunities, and other families don't.
Well, I'm going to let you go, but I got to tell you one quick story. So I'm half Norwegian. I went to Norway because my daughter was an au pair in Oslo. And the au pair in Oslo says to me, the family in Oslo says to me, I will never go back to the States and educate my children there. You guys are crazy. And I said, why? He said, you expect them to sit in a classroom at age 5, at 7, at 9, from, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning till 2:30 in the afternoon. They may get up to go to lunch, or they may, but you expect them to do this. And then you feed them just horrific food. And I said, oh, you know, you're right about the horrific food. And you're right. We do expect them to sort of be somewhat sedentary when they're 5, 6, 7, and 8. He said, you know what we do in Norway? I said, no, what do you do in Norway? He said, for every hour you spend in a classroom, You are then outside for 15 to 20 minutes. And he said, and I want to remind you, Arnie, we're not talking about a balmy climate.
Right.
We're talking about 22 below zero sometimes. He said, but it has been the expectation and what we have done forever. So nobody complains. Everybody does it. Our kids are healthier. Our kids aren't on Ritalin. Our kids need no medication and social work. They're able to accomplish the task. I just think, again, we need to look at these things. Some of these things don't cost anything, Taryn. They just need to be done. And we just don't choose to do them. So I hope this is a wake-up call, and I hope you sort of take it to the next level and keep writing about it and keep pushing us to rethink. Again, Taryn Morrissey is an associate professor at the Department of Public Administration and the Public School of Public Affairs at American University. The title of her very timely piece, Kids' School Schedules Have Never, let me repeat the word, never, matched parents' work obligations, and the pandemic is making things worse. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it, Taryn.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care. Ciao. Bye-bye. All right, everyone, stick around. When we come back, we're talking to an old friend, and we're talking about money and charity and the pandemic. We'll be right back.
Are you rain ready on this current cast? Many people in the Great Lakes region have experienced the misfortune of finding water in the basement during heavy rain. Now a free online tool called My Rain Ready can help homeowners assess and address their flood risk. Marcella Bondi Keenan of the Chicago-based Center for Neighborhood Technology says users answer questions about their home and landscaping. The tool estimates their flood risk and provides custom recommendations.
So things as simple as making sure their gutters are clear and making sure that the street sewer grates are cleared.
Or more advanced actions, such as replacing a concrete patio with a garden that will absorb stormwater and help make a home more rain-ready. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org. We'll be right back.
to cry. Share it fairly, don't take a slice of my pie. Money, so they say, is the root of all evil today. But if you ask for a rise, it's no surprise that they're giving none away. Away, 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 away,
away. I was in the right.
Yes, absolutely in the right.
I certainly was in the right.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arnison and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. I've known Alan Davis for a long time, but I've not known him in this capacity. So let me just share a little bit about him. He is a member of a group called, listen to this, Patriotic Millionaires. It almost sounds like an oxymoron. And president of the Leonard and Sophie Davis Fund. He was a founder and president of the Conservatory Paper Company, a wholesale distributor of recycled paper. But we're not talking about his past. We're sort of working more on the patriotic millionaires angle. And we're going to ask Alan to talk about two things. One was a challenge that you just put out. And philanthropy.com wrote the headline, New Pledge Asks Donors to Step Up Giving Amid Pandemic. And you have launched something called the Crisis Charitable Commitment. Now, I love this idea, but before we even get into the Crisis Charitable Commitment, let's talk a little bit about patriotic millionaires, because I think we need to put you in sort of a silo by yourself, not by yourself, but with these other patriotic millionaires, because if we understand who you are, and what your ethic is, and what drives you, then the fact that you've come up with this crisis charitable commitment makes so much sense, because it's an extension of really what you believe and how you want to protect your nation. And that's really what you want to do. Yeah, so welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Arnie. It's great to be here. So yes, Patriotic Millionaires is a group of millionaires who believe that the income inequality we're experiencing in this country is unacceptable and unpatriotic and unhealthy for our democracy and for our economy. So we're looking for ways to change that. And that includes a whole series of ideas, proposals like tax policy changes, like minimum wage, like extended health benefits, all the things that I think many of your listeners and certainly I think are essential ingredients for the kind of America we really think we're supposed to be.
Right.
So that's what the group does. And this idea of the charitable piece is just a smaller piece of a larger picture, something I call excessive wealth disorder.
I love that. Okay, keep going.
Yeah, this is the problem we have, that there's just too much money. There are people sitting on just too much money, and it's a very unhealthy situation. It just, I mean, the number that, I have trouble sleeping at night thinking about this. 650 billionaires. We have 650 billionaires in the United States. They sit on $5 trillion. Trillion, that's like 12 zeros.
Yeah.
It's a huge number. And, put it in perspective, that's twice as much as our government currently is spending to address the crisis. So it's a huge, huge amount of wealth. And, did anybody ever think there'd be a day when somebody could earn $12 billion in one day, as Jeff Bezos did? It's unfathomable. So we're trying to chip away at this inequality.
Let me just sort of remind everyone, no one is saying that they're going to strip you of all your wealth. I mean, if Jeff Bezos had to donate or pay taxes and pay an additional 20 billion even, because you know how many billions he'd still have left? And I want to remind everyone, what could a billionaire do if they had to pay a little more in taxes? What could they not do? What houses could they not buy? What countries could they not buy? You know, what jewels? The people don't get it. We are not stripping anyone of wealth. What we are saying is there's something wrong when all the wealth, especially in the last decade, instead of it being sort of spread around so that we can make people economically stable, to make people healthy, to make us sort of less frightened about the future, but when all of it goes to a handful of people, not only are they not investing it because they've got too much of it, but they are disinvesting in everybody else.
I think that's totally correct. And I mean, you could take an extreme position, or not even that extreme, but AOC would say every billionaire is a policy failure. I think there's some truth to that. But you're exactly right. We're not saying, none of the things I've been involved with are saying, take all their money. But if you just think about the fact that, let's say you wanted to leave every billionaire with $1 billion, that would still leave $4.5 trillion that I think could be better spent. I think it could be better spent on things like safe drinking water or paying people a fair wage. I mean,
Alan, tell me, so you've been hanging out with these billionaires and these millionaires your whole life. I actually said that, did they ever read the story of Midas, King Midas? You know, King Midas, everything he touched, he wanted to turn to gold until he touched his daughter, okay? And then he realized, what's the point? So here's my question that I would love to sit down with all these billionaires and ask them. What good is it to have all this money if so many people are sick? What good is it to have all this money if the climate is eroding the stability of your world? What good is it having all this money if you can't go out to dinner in all your cities because your cities are vacant? Because there is, you know, there's instability. Maybe what's-his-name wants to go to Mars. I'm just looking at the rest of us who are kind of sort of stuck on planet Earth. I am trying to figure out what it is about the allure of this money that they are willing to sacrifice really everyone's quality of life, including theirs, Alan. Including theirs.
I totally agree with you, Arnie. I mean, I think there's a case to be made that there's a certain sense of billionaires being psychopaths, that they have completely been disconnected from the real world and basic human feelings about other people. So it's not, I mean, there are certainly exceptions to the rule, but what's interesting, I think, is that one of the ways a billionaire expresses their goodness, or at least covers up for their hoarding, is make charitable contributions.
Yes.
And so we see very splashy headlines about a billionaire giving $10 million for this or $20 million for that. And what people don't seem to understand is that that's generally like, that's like 1 month's income. That's not like being generous. Like when, you know, when the church used to tithe people and say, we're giving 10% of your income. I mean, this is money that I call it stoop change. I mean, they wouldn't notice the 10 million, like you were saying before, that they wouldn't notice the $10 million is missing. Basically, this effort that we call the crisis charitable commitment is an effort to try to get people to actually step up and meet their responsibility. And if they don't meet it during this pandemic, this is the rainy day. You know, we're here. This is it. And people are suffering in so many different ways. There are so many tremendous needs. And for somebody to sit on the sidelines and think this is a business as usual day is truly a tragedy. So we're trying to encourage people to recognize their responsibility, show their leadership, step up to the plate, and give generously.
You also wrote an op-ed, and it was about sort of, you sort of took to task some of these very well-known foundations. Well, the one that sort of jumped off the plate was Ford. This is the part, tell my audience how much money these foundations have made in the last decade. They didn't have a tough time in the last 10 years. They've had a remarkable time in the last 10 years. And ostensibly, a foundation is created to give money away. Their job is to take care of people, to be charitable, to give money away. So we know that they now are sitting on a Mount Everest of cash. They've done incredibly well. Tell what Ford was suggesting they wanted to do. Because at first I went, well, that sounds interesting. And then when you explained it in your op-ed, I mean, my middle fingers went up in stereo. So I want you to tell my audience a little bit about these foundations and this clever idea that ain't so clever.
Well, it was reported in the New York Times and other places that five major foundations looked like they were stepping up to the plate and dipping into their endowments. So the foundation has this stash of money that they sit on, and the earnings from that endowment is what they make their charitable contributions from. So Ford was a sort of a leader in this effort and made a big splash by saying that the law requires them to give away 5% of their endowment every year, which was set up back in the late 60s when a foundation thought maybe we'll earn 6%, maybe we'll earn 7%. And so that will keep us sort of even. But since that time, we've been earning 10% a year, every year. There have been some exceptions, but overall, 10% a year, and the foundations are still just giving away 5% of their wealth. So Ford, facing this incredible crisis, and they are a leader in the field of caring, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. Healthcare is big for Ford.
Yeah. They said that we're going to increase our giving, but in order to increase our giving, we're not going to dip into our endowment. We're going to go ask people to lend us money to pay for it. And I thought, wow, that's kind of nervy. Like, they have made, in the last 3 years, they have made $2 billion, and they're increasing their giving by $500 million. Well, if you think about that, that's only like 25% of what they made in the last 3 years. So that did not strike me as very generous. And this is true of the foundation world in general. There's very few of these. There are billionaire foundations. There are 80 foundations that are sitting on $1 billion or more. And so far, and none of them are dipping into their endowments, even though they've been making money hand over fist.
I know you're not an accountant or a lawyer, but I just got to ask. So what is the financial angle on borrowing money when you're sitting on a mountain of cash? Because if you're borrowing money, where are you borrowing the money from? What's the payback? What's the tax write-off? I mean, I'm playing this out and I'm thinking they're going to make money on borrowing the money because I don't want to touch their mountain of money. I mean, this is like, you know why I'm so upset about this, Alan? Because I wrote a lot on my Facebook page about just the amazing stuff in your articles. I was just like so out of my mind. And I'm thinking, remember what the GOP is saying, that extra $600 a week to those unemployed people, that's too much money. It's too rich. You can't have so much. And then I'm reading your article and I want a split screen. I want people to see this story and then see the extra $600. And the reason I say this, and you're now hearing it more and more, I've been saying it now for months, is that every single dime of that unemployment money is going into the economy. It's making those billionaires even more rich, okay? Amazon is doing well in part because of that $600, because they're spending every dime, every dime.
Let me just tell you how well they're doing. The billionaires have made $500 billion since the crisis began. $500 billion since the crisis began. Yes, you can get angry about this.
I do want to grab my pitchfork. I will tell you, I got a couple in the garage, so I'm going to keep picking. I'm going to take a picture with the pitch. But I want people to know I'm not angry that they're rich. I'm not even jealous that they're rich. I am just asking, what is wealth for? Again, as I pointed out before, and I'm also saying, at what point in time do you have enough? Is there ever an answer to that? You're going to be disappointed in me. Hillary Clinton never came on the air with me when she ran for president. And I know why.
because she heard the question I wanted to ask her. And this is absolutely the truth. The question I wanted to ask her, Ellen, is when she left the State Department and she spent 15 months before she finally announced that she was running for president. And she basically went on the speaking market and she raised $21 million, not for her campaign, but for her. At the time she did that, she and Bill were actually pretty rich already. All right. So it's not like the $21 million was something they needed because she was only earning maybe $200,000 as Secretary of State. I don't know what they earned that. But it was because she wanted more money. And I wanted to ask her the question, you were already rich when you left the State Department. When are you rich enough? And she's not even close to being the billionaires we're talking about. She's not Jeff Bezos who makes $13 or $12 billion in one day. And the reason that has to be asked is, it's not only about your selfishness, it's about how can you look at people struggling during a pandemic and feel that there's any sense of right by sitting on all this money?
That's exactly what the Crisis Charitable Commitment is all about. And we're focused at a group of people that are, we call the 0.1%. That's 0.1% of families in America have wealth of $25 million or more, $25 million or more. There's 150,000 of us who have that. And we're asking them to, just as you're suggesting, step up to the plate, give back. This is the time, if you're ever going to do it, if you're going to show that you care at all about the American public, this is your chance to give back. And there are, you can give back in, we're saying you can give back in any number of ways, any way you want to. Because virtually any money you put out into the nonprofit sector right now is going to do good. I mean, whether it be for food banks or whether it's to support Black Lives Matter or whether it's to help it with hospitals or even universities, or everybody is hurting. Theaters are hurting. Yeah. Everybody is hurting. So just give back. It's time to give back. It's exactly your question. You know, when is enough enough? And this is particularly troubling because of the amount of money people have been making for years, as long as anybody can remember. The market has been in a boom cycle, and wealthy people are the major beneficiaries of that, and which is part of the reasons our wealth gap has grown so much. Taxes is the other reason, but we have to give back. That's what this is all about. So we're trying to find people to say, yeah, I'm signing on. I'm with you. We're going to do our, we're going to take our responsibility seriously. If you have money, you have privilege and you have responsibility. So we're trying to tap into the responsibility part.
It's always interesting to me. And I think that there, you've seen the rise and the disconnect in some ways, as we've seen this sort of the rise of the multinational, and that, you know, you could then sort of pocket your money in other places. You could create jobs other places. So the idea of being a patriot, the idea of connection to place, has really begun to be stretched, because I don't think they really see themselves as Americans. I see themselves as billionaires, but there doesn't necessarily have to be a nationality connected to that billion. And when there isn't a nationality connected to that billion, there isn't that sense of community. There isn't that sense of obligation. I live in Concord now, and I've lived all over the state of New Hampshire, and I've lived in different places of the country. And I've always told people that was for the first time in my life, I feel like I've come home, all right? I really feel a sense of home. And I always thought that I wanted to be in Concord to be the governor. What a fool. I wanted to be in Concord because I love this little city. And I obviously love my state. It drives me crazy sometimes, but I love my state. So there's a real connection and a sense that, what is it within the Jewish community? The idea is you make your heaven here. And if you make your heaven here, then you have an obligation to make these investments, to take care of these people. You talked about what the Ford Foundation had come up with, and a number of other of these larger foundations had come up with the idea that instead of spending their money, they're going to borrow in sort of in order to maintain it. I have an idea. Why don't we change that 5% rule that was established in 1960, whatever, and why don't we make it a 10 or 15% rule? Why don't we, if there's one thing to tackle, you're going to be sitting on that cash. I understand you want to have that cash for a while. In a way, it's also your power as well as your investment. But why are we in a, you know, 50-year-old or 60-year-old mode when, in fact, we should recognize not only the moment, but that the moment requires a change in that kind of investment?
I think you're ahead of the game here, because there's actually a bill that's been introduced into Congress called the Emergency Charitable Stimulus Bill. And that bill calls for a 10% payout requirement, just exactly what you said, a 10% payout requirement for 3 years. So it's only a temporary bill at the moment. Congress, the House of Representatives, is struggling with it to see whether they will include it in the next bailout package. But that bill would add $200 billion to the amount of money going out to the nonprofit community. So that would be a tremendous first step. And we're actually just tapping into it with our voluntary 10% payout requirement. That's what we're asking foundations and donor advised funds to do, is to pay out a minimum of 10% this year. So we're doing it on a voluntary basis, basically to show that, yeah, we can do this, we should do this, we must do this. But there's the possibility of legislation coming down that will require it. And there's a related problem, though, that we have to be aware of, which is we are living in an age of what's being called gilded philanthropy, where a bunch of very wealthy people and foundations control just about everything. They could determine what you get to see in a museum. They determine what diseases we're going to try to cure, right? Rather than having a democratically decided process for making these kinds of decisions, we now have this government outside of government making decisions. How our kids get schooled is being determined by very wealthy people and foundations. And so ultimately, we have to address this problem of excessive wealth disorder. We have to address the problem that people have just too much money, foundations have too much money. And one of the ways to begin is to start giving back. And we're hoping to demonstrate that there's enough people who have hoarded this money willing to give back.
So as you're describing, and I think of the Koch brothers and what they've done when they've invested in different colleges, and then the expectation of what they're to teach, and what is the funded chair, and what does the funded chair teach? I mean, and you've seen it over and over again, and you're absolutely right about the museums and what they can do. And so as I'm thinking about these incredibly interesting charitable individuals who then demand that you behave a certain way, and I keep thinking of them, and I want to really call them what they are: benevolent despots. Because that's exactly what they are. And what scares me, Alan, and why we need to have more of these conversations, is we already know about money in politics. We already know about the revolving door. We already know about the lobbyists. We already see that how much money have they made, how many billions have they made during the time of the pandemic. We already know that they only are required, the foundations, to give 5%, and that was written in 1960, and they are swimming in cash today, so they're actually sitting on it. Then we find out that the Ford Foundation wants to borrow money and not spend their own damn cash. So you add all this together, and if you paint that picture, it's a picture of really not being patriotic. I'm so glad you called yourselves the Patriotic Millionaires, because you don't know this, but we begin every show with the voice of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, because I want my audience to hear this every single day until the election, because I want them to remember what patriotism sounds like. I want them to remember what it is to be selfless. I want them to understand he knew he was risking his career, not millions, but his life's work to testify. All we're asking of these gazillionaires is not for them to give up their 17 homes, their Maseratis. They're going to be beyond wealthy even when we're done, but people will be better off around them because of what they've done. And
that's
to me,
exactly right.
it would make me smile. You know, instead of feeling threatened, it would make me smile.
Well, that's the part that I find so troubling, because all the research shows that people feel better when they help others. It's a given, and yet the rich are not giving. I mean, just to put it in perspective, the rich have been giving at a rate of 1% of their wealth for, say, the last 10 years. That's 1% when they're earning 10%. So there's a disconnect here. It's like they're just piling wealth on top of wealth, and there's no reason for it. What more are they going to buy? What is it exactly? Which painting are they going to hang in their living room that's worth more than somebody having clean drinking water. I just don't. This is a disconnect.
And let me just stop you, because they'll still have that painting and you can still have the drinking water. Alan Davis, I am so honored and proud that I can call you not only my friend, but someone that I totally, totally admire. He is a member of the Patriotic Millionaires. He's president of the Leonard and Sophie Davis Fund. He was the founder and president of Conservatory Paper Company, a wholesale distributor, of course, recycled paper, and a rich guy who gets it. So thank you so much for leading the way, Alan.
Okay, thank you, Arnie.
All right, ciao. All right, everyone. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We'll schmooze tomorrow. You bet.